Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I am very happy to welcome to our radio station Max Dashew. Max Dashew founded the Suppressed Histories Archives in the 1970s to document global women's history. She joins us for a conversation on women in history and then their all-too-absence in the telling of history. She is the author of the book Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, 700 to 1100. It is volume 7 of a multi-volume series telling the history of women and the suppressed histories. You can also find more online at suppressedhistories.net. You can find it on Facebook. Max Dashew, it's my good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station. Thank you for being here. And I should say welcome back. Many years ago, you had a show on sister station KPFA where we're broadcasting from.
Yes, we, Hannah Wilson and I did a show on international women's music.
Wow. Tell me, what was the first thing that you would say when someone asks you about women and history?
We have to reexamine the entire cultural record to rewrite women into history. You know, there are a lot of records that have just basically been passed over. Certainly there's a lot that was never actually written down because of the way that history, you know, we have this divide between history, anthropology, archaeology, the base of knowledge, the cultural record has been split up into all these categories. So if you want indigenous women's history, then you have to look under ethnography a lot of times in the library, just based on the way they have divided everything up. But I think to do women's history, you have to look into the common people. You have to look into the ethnic cultures, which is why witches and pagans, it's really an ethno-history. You know,
when, what does that mean, ethno-history?
Ethno-history means you're looking to document what was the culture, how did people live, what did they say, what were their oral traditions, what were their spiritual traditions, their social organization, anything that you can get about, are there systems of domination, you know, what are the sexed parameters of domination, if any, within that culture. And so ethnohistory is a different angle because what the history we're given is kings, lords, conquerors, generals, and sometimes male scientists and philosophers, the literary side of things. But women are invisible in all of that.
Yeah.
You know, you get people, they'll give you Queen Elizabeth I, or they'll give you certain aristocratic women and say, okay,
Catherine,
well, that's
great.
Right. And it's like that is just really a sideline to women's history, the way I'm conceiving it, which is looking at social organization, female spheres of power, as I like to call it, because this is something that's invisible to us historically. We don't get it in our grade school or high school education. It doesn't come through really in college very much. It certainly doesn't come through in the way the media presents history to us. And this is where a lot of people get their concept of who humans are and what our social systems have been like or how they varied from each other. So often there's a presumption of male domination and patriarchy, just as there is for white domination, right? The white supremacist scripts are very much implicated in this universal patriarchy narrative that I was given when I went to college. You know, there are no societies in which women were not dominated, was basically the party line at that time. And it hasn't shifted a great deal even now since then.
Well, it's interesting to think about. And we do a lot of history on this program, and we also fall into this paradigm that you are pointing out, and it concerns me. And I guess it's easy to think, okay, the problem is women have been suppressed throughout civilization. Obviously, I'm sure we could find exceptions. But because of that suppression and perhaps inability to participate in civic life, in the political life, whatever it may be, and military life, in which seems to dominate history so much, that would be one reason why we don't have that history told as much. Is that wrong? What do you think about that?
It's complicated because certainly even in those periods, say, for example, if we're looking at Greco-Roman civilization or Egyptian civilization or Chinese civilization, there are women to be found. But the way we're taught, we are not given those women. I mean, that's being fixed a little bit. You know, there's some revisions that have taken place. So now they can say, well, yeah, there was this really powerful woman named Fu Hao, who was not only a general, but also perhaps a figure of spiritual leadership. So she had a very powerful, a very, very major burial in the Shang Dynasty. It's just that we don't get to see that, those aspects. So there's actually two layers. There's one, or to be at the minimum, there is what the cultural record of that time actually says, and then what parts of that come through to us. Because there's constantly this editorial gatekeeping that goes on. Like, for example, I'm doing webcasts this week on pre-dynastic Egypt. And so I was reading over my notes, which go back decades, and it was amazing to me because the visual talk that I put together based on the archaeology shows either priestesses or goddess with their arms upraised standing in a ceremonial boat. And this is in ceramic painting, rock art, sculpture, all kinds of different media. And yet the summaries of that period written by various historians completely ignored the existence of that, which seems to be the defining trope, actually, of the symbolism, the cultural symbolism. And instead, they are only mentioning penis sheaths and, you know, incipient pharaoh themes, stuff like that. But they simply omit. And this is one of our problems, is that because when I began, I dropped out of college in 1969 to do this. There was no women's history at that time. There was no women's studies.
You've been doing this for 40 years.
50.
50 years.
It'll be 50 years this fall. And, you know, at that time, I lost my thread there.
That's okay.
Women's history was literally a joke. You know, so I didn't feel that I could pursue it within the, I decided to become an
within
independent
the university,
scholar.
Within
right.
the academia.
You know,
yeah.
Well, you're going to go up against all these professors. I mean, I didn't know enough at the time, but I had a very strong gut feeling that what they were telling me, males have always dominated, was wrong. So I just broke out on my own and thought, well, so basically it becomes then a project of let us explore the cultural record and see what's there. And at that moment, I thought, well, you know, it's all been destroyed. I had a very strong intuition that other matricultural or egalitarian systems have existed, you know, but at that time, you know, where are they? Let's try to find them. And we were given nothing about that. I mean, nobody was talking about the Mosuo society in southwest China or the Vanatinai Islanders off the coast of Australia, or you could just name the Pueblo societies, the Iroquoian Confederacy, the lot of different matricultural societies that are historical realities, and yet archaeologists have been very resistant to saying, well, maybe there really are these other social paradigms other than power over, you know.
The Iroquois and Confederation?
Yeah, the Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee.
A great contributor to democracy.
Well, right, and this is like the great law of peace. This is one of our best pieces of evidence that, in fact, egalitarian systems and actually co-gendered power balances are possible because they encoded this. It was in the oral tradition first, and then it was written down, I believe, in the 1700s. But the Great Law of Peace has major elements in there that there's a women's council, there are the women elders, and they can knock the horns off the chief. They select him, but if he becomes corrupt or power hungry, they can take him out. You know, if the men's council makes a decision to go to war, the women's council can veto that. So, you know, when we learn now, as we are, about the bicameral House of Congress and all the other influences which the Iroquoian polity did have on U.S. social polity or politics, that is the element that is omitted on a regular basis, is the fact that they also had a balance of power not only between two governmental houses, but between males and females. You know, and there was a lot of structural power, economic power in the hands of women because they also were, they controlled the food supply. You know, Barbara Mann, who is a Seneca historian, who I really recommend, you should have her on. She wrote a book called Iroquoian Women, the Gantowisas. And she calls the Gantowisas, which is their name for the female elders, the Federal Reserve Board of the Six Nations.
Federal Reserve.
Yeah, because they basically, the women were raising, they were the farmers. And then they had like these park-like, they weren't herders, they had deer, but they actually promoted the conditions for the deer to live, so they were living in a balanced way. And so the men did the hunting, by and large. I mean, there are always exceptions to all of this, you know. It's not a rigid gender system. But once they handed over the deer to the women tanned the hides, they did all everything else, and then it passed into their guardianship. And they were the ones, you know, the feasts that were held by women were like a core foundation for any social, religious, or political gathering, you know. So if a council was to be held, they would call the council. The women would call the council, and they would host it. And that's very different than the concept in European or many other forms of patriarchy, the idea that women's serving of food is in some way a servitor role, a secondary and a lesser aspect.
That's how we see it, yeah.
Right. You know, but then if you look at it and you have to really stretch your mind around to see this is a completely other way of looking at it, they are providing life force to the entire community. And within that context, the social coming together happens. And it's a gift
and
economy.
And to be respected as that.
Yes. You know, to have authority based, because the women are doing all this work, but unlike in a patriarchal society, there's no authority that attaches to you from all the responsibilities you shoulder. You just do them. You don't get paid for them, and you don't get anything more than maybe lip service on Mother's Day, you know, for doing them, right? But that does not give you social, economic, much less political power or spiritual power.
But it could.
It does in many systems. It has in egalitarian systems. It's just that what patriarchy does is it colonizes that gifting of the women, that way that women hold up the entire life matrix, right? So it's a parasitical relation because it has to do with who's going to control women's sexuality, reproductive power, labor, or even just the psychic colonization that we see predominant. Now, and this is where I'm going. This was a lot of the reason for pursuing the tracking back through European culture and looking at, well, how patriarchal was it and how did that work? You know, what are the concrete mechanisms of domination there? And what other cultural modes were still in existence in those societies, say, in early medieval Europe, which is the period I'm looking at here?
With this, with your latest book.
Yeah. You know, what are the modes in which there were, in fact, still female spheres of power? And so what I'm examining here is spiritual leadership. You know, the Völler in Scandinavia, a lot of different names. There's a whole chapter on names of the witch here that looks at culturally recognized titles for the knowledge that women had and their activity in healing, prophecy, herbal medicine, a whole realm, prophecy certainly being looming very large.
We're going to dive into that. Mm-hmm. Before we get there, though, I do want to ask you, what is the method? How do you uncover these suppressed histories through time?
My method has to been to read everything I can get my hands on. And in a variety of fields, you're going to find one type of information going through the written medieval literature, another type going through the archaeological record. And then there's this whole mythic record. Some of it is from sources from later periods, but they're carrying along stories that linguistically and otherwise can be verified as having older roots. That's a lot of what I do in this book.
The etymology of words.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
It
and what
is.
You did in this book was fascinating. Tell me about words. And,
right.
And how words for you reveal history.
Yeah, words, linguistic origins, the etymologies can give us a track that we can trace back. So, for example, in the names of the witch, my starting point was, okay, is there any evidence for women as spiritual leaders in these European societies, the name witch, as we know, became intensely demonized in European civilization. We had a whole process, really actually 1,000 years of witch hunts within European civilization, and more than that if you count going back in ancient times to the Greeks. But so the witch is a demonized category for us now. And so one of the things I started with earliest was to look at that root word, which comes from Proto-Indo-European wick, and the meanings of that. Now, this is a word that is still disputed. Linguistics have not arrived at a consensus. So there's one root that means to turn, bend, twist, kind of a shape-shifty, like the way that trees grow. The witch elm, for example, has curling branches. So that's one root. And that is also where wicker comes from, where you've got this twining of like a basketry kind of thing. Another meaning of wick is connected with the sacred. And so some linguists have pointed to that as the root for witch, which is much more underlying her spiritual aspect. And then there's a third root, which has to do with live, the root of live. So like when you see place names in England, Sandwich, Warwick, that's that form. It means a living place. In Latin, it would be vicus. All right. So they haven't decided on this. And I parsed this all out. We're not going to do that here. But you can read chapter 2 of the book and see the arguments for each of those meanings. But then, see, there's a whole other group. So in the chapter that's called The Names of the Witch, I look at folk names for witches or for women of spiritual power, seers, healers, all that, just to see what the root meaning of those names is. And that's what you get. You don't get a devil worshiper. You don't get someone who does harmful magic. You're finding knower, seer, shapeshifter, healer. The word libistra is really fascinating. This is an Anglo-Saxon word that was in use as recently as 1,000 years ago. And the root for it, lib, means it's related to the word for life. So in Icelandic, it's luf. And in Old High German, it's lupa. But that life word, then there's a whole array of meanings. So there's vitality, there's life force, there's medicine, there's healing. It can be specified off into a healing herb, which is what they think in Norwegian, the meaning kind of coalesced around that. But in Anglo-Saxon, libistra meant a woman who heals. So you could really literally translate libistra as medicine woman. You know, just like the term you see used now in North America a lot. So, and then there's related words that mean amulet and other kinds of things. This undergoes the same pressures as all of the other female spheres of power do under a Christian feudal and then later on capitalist society, so that there's this demonization energy vortex that's pulling on these words. And so eventually libluck comes to mean poisoning. You know, so you see a demonization even of these words, but a lot of them...
Is this with the onset of Christianity in Europe?
It's with the imposition of a very authoritarian form of Christianity that happens in this period I'm talking about in the early Middle Ages. You know, so that the priests
is this
regarded...
Roman Empire?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
So
we're talking about everything from the 6th century onward. Yeah. 7th century, 8th century onward. That's the time span I'm looking at. Okay. And Roman definitions and concepts exert a very strong influence because for the priesthood, that's definitive. Latin, everything has to be parsed through a Roman and a Latinate template. And the historians actually have a word for this. They call it interpretatio Romana. This is why we see the name Diana coming up over and over again. It wasn't maybe in some cases, like in Gaul, like in the 800s, you have monks talking about people who are worshiping Diana, and then there was a shrine of Diana and how they knocked down her statue. Maybe the Gauls, because they were very Romanized, actually used that name. You know, there was a lot of syncretism even in the Roman Empire between native goddesses and then the Roman overlay.
Right.
But in most cases, the goddess was named something else in the ethnic religion. It's just that the priesthood really didn't want to use those names. They didn't want to preserve them. They didn't want to, they were trying to impose this Romanist template over everything. So only in a very few cases do they actually give us those names, you know. And the narrative about Diana is interesting for another reason.
And Diana's a goddess.
She's a Roman goddess of the moon.
Of the moon.
Of the moon and also of the hunt. So we could do a whole other show talking about that in the Roman context. You know, there's some very interesting things. But basically, here come the priests. The Roman Empire collapses, and then gradually feudalism rises up. And there was a lot of afterglow to the Roman prestige and authority. And the Christian church really preserved a lot of the forms of the Roman Empire. So, for example, we think of diocese as an ecclesiastical term, but it was borrowed from the Roman Empire's structure of power that applied to state organizations. And so the church kept a lot of that ethos in its structure, in its ideology, and certainly in its language that it insisted on imposing. So mass
curia,
has to be said
right?
In Latin.
Yeah.
Right.
The curia, the sort of the governing body of the
right, and then the whole substructure to that, because the bishops, the archbishops, the cardinals, and then on down to the local priests.
That came from the
diocese
of the yeah. Roman Empire.
Right, yeah. Exactly. You know, and so they preserved that with all the cultural presumptions that were embedded into it, including this very intense patriarchy.
Yeah.
So the priestess.
Yeah, patriarchy is.
Yeah, I mean that's
baked into it.
It's baked into it, and so there could not be priestesses within this framework. They had already knocked that out. They did exist under the Roman Empire, but by the late Empire, there was this move to push women entirely out. This is one of the reasons why it forced Christianization that was imposed on Europe by states, by the aristocratic lords. Alliance with the church had such a negative impact on women's status because they forbade. And there are examples like the Bretons and in Sicily, there are still examples of women acting as priestesses in the Christian church. You know, there's evidence for that, but they knocked that out as fast as they could. So then that has implications that carry on in all kinds of directions. It means that anyone, female, who's acting in spiritual leadership is necessarily seen as a witch, a heretic, you know, someone who is a target. You know, there's a repression that's brought to bear, and it takes centuries for this to take hold, not just from the top down, where they're, you know, going after them, the lords are persecuting witches in their local realms, but also eventually by the late Middle Ages, that repression and that demonization has taken hold among the common people. And this is what really enables the mass witch hunts to take place, because there's a cultural shift.
It's an evolution.
Been brought. Yeah.
That,
or a
that
devolution.
Gets you, or, fair enough.
Yeah.
But a process over centuries that would get you to real witch hunts, witch burning,
or mass, let's say mass witch hunts.
Mass witch hunts, the accusation of people, of women being witches.
The pattern of it, okay? And so part of what I'm documenting here is how what was originally what you could call a shamanic mythology of people who have spiritual connections, who fly through the air, you know, they're doing trance ceremonies, they're having dealings with the spirit world, and in this framework, women who go by night with the goddess is the original template, Diana often being named by the priests,
who go with the goddess at night,
right? You know, so there's like a dreaming aspect to this. It's spirit journeys. All right. And it's tied in the mythology to the pagan holidays. So it's connected ultimately to ceremonial bonfires and dances in places of power. That's the core folk narrative. But over the course of at least 500 years, this foundation gets demonized and torqued around until it becomes a defining mythology, the witch hunters, in which the women are snatched up by the devil and carried off, and they become it's slaves of the devil, so that you have the Christian anti-god displacing the folk deity of the folk orature, you know, the oral traditions of the people. And that took a long time, so that they're changing. And so by the 1400s, you've got Torquemada is saying Diana is the devil. You know.
So Diana was referred to as the devil come
well, in that
times,
you know,
of what, the Inquisition?
In the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah.
Torquemada was one of the big men that started up the Spanish Inquisition. But that's very late, you see. We have all this other layers to look at before that. And so
when did this transition from, you know, within the Roman system when women could be priestesses to when they could not?
Okay, so even in the early church, they weren't necessarily calling them priestesses, but in Christian parlance of the time, they were prophetesses. Okay, it didn't mean predictors of the future. It was somebody who spoke truth. And so you have reference, even in the Christian scriptures, to women as prophetesses. In Asia Minor, that was a predominant cultural pattern, so that you have the people who are referred to as Montanists, named after a man, it was actually two female prophets in that tradition, and they were Christian. And their concept was Christ was going to return as the Paraclete in a female form. So this Paraclete heresy continues all the way through in the next 1,000 years into medieval Italy. You're still seeing it. But the Roman persecution has a lot of aspects. For example, a lot of priestess traditions came in from colonies of Rome. And so in the plebeian neighborhoods of Rome, Aventine Hill, for example, was a center where people of all different ethnicities were syncretizing their spiritual traditions. And these were ecstatic mass movements, you know, with torches, night processions, drums, chanting, scared the pants off the Roman patricians had they worn pants. They were really threatened by that. So there was a persecution that took place in 186 BCE that is
referred— This is still the Republic.
This is under the Republic. And Livy taught— he's our only source, basically. There's very little else written. But he talks about a mass massacre of the Bacchanalia, the people who were participating in a combination of the Greek mysteries with Syrian elements, various ethnicities all bound up together through the common people.
Right. I mean, the Roman Empire or even the Republic was a multicultural.
Right. Well, and the more it became an empire, the more multicultural it became. Because
right.
as we're seeing here, the people of the conquered provinces come to the imperial centers.
As it did in England.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So this persecution, some of the points of the ideology of this hunt, this first mass witch hunt is the way I see it, were the same as what is later applied, more than 1,000 years later in Europe. So the idea that there is this conspiracy, that there are these evil people, that, there's accusations that it's predominantly a female movement, but there are men in there who may be homosexual, may be trans, we don't really know. It's just like all negative characterizations by the Romans. And the Senate decrees this has to be stamped out. And they close the gates of Rome and they kill everybody they can get, you know. And so that's Livy's narrative. And there are other points I'm not really able to pull up in my mind of similarity to the way that this was characterized. They were not giving some of the accusations that were later used against the witches, like baby killing, for example, were not present. But many of the elements were parallels, so that there, too, we see some Roman predecessors of the accusations and the— You know, this is really important for us now, the way that accusations and persecution are formed, to spread mass fear of any particular social group, as these harm-doers who remotely cause damage, from a distance. The idea that witches, by thought crime, can somehow harm people, right? And then that makes them targets. And the targeting of the witches, the violence against them, is a social safety valve for the ruling powers, right? So in the, throughout much of medieval history and later, the Jews were targeted in this way. They were a very useful shield for the ruling aristocracy, and the peasants' wrath against their actual oppressors could be turned easily and vent that anger on the Jews and the pogroms that arose in the 1300s, various different times in the Crusades, even earlier than that. Through something that's known as the blood libel, the accusation that Jews sacrificed Gentile boys as part of their Passover rites. And this continued to spark pogroms right through the 1900s, in the late 1800s, I should say. The mechanisms of scapegoating. So there's a lot of commonalities in the way that the persecutions of Jews functioned in Europe and the way that the persecutions of women as witches, predominantly women. And we could name a whole group of vulnerabilities, social vulnerabilities, certainly female, predominantly commoners. This didn't happen in the main to aristocratic women, certainly not aristocratic men, unless they became political targets. And even in those cases, like you have a couple bishops who their enemies, their aristocratic enemies, tried to get them by saying, they had done these magical rites. But in the main, even there, it would be a common witch who would be the scapegoat. She would be the fall girl for that, so that the bishop might escape, but she would be burned at the stake for having supposedly helped him perform whatever, ceremony that he was being accused of. So, it's very strongly sexed. That's one element. But it's also got a very strong class element, because the beliefs that they're targeting and the practices they're targeting predominantly exist within the common people, within the peasantry. And this is where these old modes of healing—
So it's adopted.
The peasantry was like the mother lode for these old ethnic ways. They were the ones that held on them to them the longer. It was the elites, and predominantly this is a masculine enforced thing. Okay, the elites come after them and they say, this is diabolical, you have to stop doing these practices. Even when they were applied to Christianity, it's like, we don't want you circumambulating around the church. That was, they knew that was a pagan thing, right. And they did their best to stamp that out. They succeeded in various ways and in varying degrees depending on where you are. So the more remote a community is, the longer these old ethnic ways remained. The more urban it was, the more they were within reach of power, you know, and there was much more ability to do this cultural repression and to bring them into line.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Max Dashew. Max Dashew founded the Suppressed Histories Archives in the 1970s to document global women's history. You can find it online at suppressedhistories.net. She is also the author of the book Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, 700 to 1100. Max Dashew, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned it earlier, the connection to Indo-Europeans.
This is a name that was invented by linguists in the 1800s because they discovered, imagine this, that English and Sanskrit had common lexical relations to each other. And so a
words
study...
like father, mother...
Right.
Like
all kinds
Sanskrit's
of...
Sanskrit's pater
right.
rather than father.
Right. Uh-huh. Pater, just like Latin, right?
Yeah.
Or Peter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
So... they discovered these interrelationships, and in the wake of that, there's been a whole field of study that's evolved showing that not just those two, English and Sanskrit, but also Irish, Lithuanian, Greek, Baltic languages like Lithuanian, Armenian, Persian, Germanic, Italic, Celtic, all are related. So they talk about a ancient group of people that are known as the Proto-Indo-Europeans, from which all of these branched out. So that's a linguistic field of study, but it has historical implications, you know, especially, you know, here I am using linguistics to show ethnic patterns, you know, of religious practices and others. So what happens historically, and this is something that's really now being well documented in archaeology as we go into the genome. The first layer of evidence was written. The second layer of it was archaeological. The third layer of it was linguistic and seeing, wow, okay, here's Germanic and here's the Celtic form and here's the Russian form. But and then the final layer, or maybe it's not the final, maybe there'll be another one, is looking at the genome.
Yeah.
So now the genome studies are actually vindicating Maria Gimbutas's theory about European origins because she talks about invasions from people out of the steppes, out of the Ukrainian Eurasian steppe into Europe, conquering older populations in Europe, and that she refers to as old Europe. So the genome is showing us there's three basic groups. There are the foraging peoples, the hunter-gatherers as they call them, that are the oldest layer coming out of Africa. Then there is another wave that comes out of Southwest Asia, like out of what's now Turkey, in that direction, Syria, and migrate up through the Balkans, along the rivers, and gradually settle, and eventually begin to intermarry with the foraging peoples. And then on top of that is the last layer of major migrations that had a very devastating effect. They're thinking now that plagues are part of this, and not only conquest alone, of the steppe peoples, the Kurgan people, as Gimbutas names them. And there is a lot of evidence now that these were probably speakers of Indo-European languages, you know. So those languages have an implicate political order in them of patriarchy because of the way that the names for relatives show residence with the male, okay, rather than the female.
So you find patriarchy within the European,
you find patriarchy
Indo-European
in a lot of ways, yeah. In a lot of ways. And not only patriarchy, but somewhat of a class system, a chieftaincies maybe, if not kings. There's an argument about that. But there's a male domination encoded into that system, which is still manifested in all of its descendant societies. And my position with this book is not to say, oh, it was all matriarchal before the Christians or before the Romans, because these are Indo-European societies in the main. But that, in fact, there were... it's complicated. There were female spheres of power even in those Indo-European societies. There's also another group of people, well, two actually, one in Iberia. You have the Basques. They don't speak an Indo-European language. They are the oldest residents that we know of, you know, the last shore, as you could call it, of the what I call the elder kindreds. And the Iberians, whose language is now a dead language, but there are other peoples in that area of Spain and the Pyrenees perhaps as well, who are speakers of non-Indo-European languages. Those groups are overwhelmed. They're overrun. And the Basques are like a last group standing.
Bastion.
And then over, if you go up to the northeast, and especially the north of Europe, you have the Sami. And they are also an elder kindred of great antiquity who were gradually forced further and further north to the margins of Europe. But everybody else, except the one-third exception, the Hungarians come in, and the Bulgars. So you do have one other group of non-Indo-European speakers, but the bulk of Europe was basically Indo-Europeanized at a fairly early age.
I think one can make an argument that civilization and slavery are very much connected.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think civilization and patriarchy, the history of civilization and patriarchy, are also connected?
Yeah, I mean, as long as you're defining civilization, I mean, you know, that word has taken on so much prestige that sometimes people use it for societies that are not domination-based, that are simply maybe technically or, you know, gifted in whatever way. But, you know, in the sense of a hierarchical, class-stratified, male-dominated society, then yeah. I mean, you know, civilization tends to imply a militarization, a state structure. It implies even specialization of crafts. So that, like, you know, in an indigenous polity or socioeconomic system, you know, everybody in the family can, you know, the women are making pottery and weaving or, you know, whatever the crafts are that they're doing. There aren't necessarily specialization where you have a market and people go and get those objects at a market. They're self-sufficient. You know, it's much more of a permaculture or however you want to say it. But slavery is really important in all of this, even in looking at patriarchy, because of the way that anthropology had a saying, early slavery is female slavery. They kill the men of the enemy group and they capture the women, maybe sometimes the children. So, you know, one of the things this does, I mean, first of all, taking people into slavery is a bad thing to begin with, but it had really negative implications for women's status. They were potential chattel, right? And so there's a way in which there's this interweave of patriarchy and slavery, patriarchy and class systems. You can see this with the Romans, where you have the plebeians, who are literally the people, and the patricians, who are those of the father, you know, those who follow the father. So you've got famous quotes from Cato talking about how, oh, the plebeians don't know who their fathers are. This was a dividing line of social status. You know, so the correlation is patriarchy, upper class, and then this matricultural system is much more in the foundation of the commoners, you know. And so this is something that still continues, although you have patriarchal social relations in medieval Europe, the way that marriage is done, there is male domination in these societies. There is still room to maneuver among the common people, you know, that an individual woman could gain status and renown even. You know, people would come from a long way around to be treated by a famous healer because they needed the guidance she had. There are even references in northwestern Germany. There was a revolt of serfs against the church, who was like one of the, it was the biggest landowner in Germany, in Europe. The Stedingers are described as having sibyls who led their revolt. So, you know, this is
sibyls.
Really sibyls, like female prophets. There are these old patterns.
That's what the name Sibyl means.
Yeah, well, the Sibyl, there's a whole, this is again back to the Roman and Greek literature, but there are Sibyls that are renowned from different parts of the ancient world. So there's the Sibyl of Albunea, which is near Rome, and then there's the Sibyl of Cumae, which is down by Naples. And so there were Sibyls all around the Mediterranean. They refer to the fact that there are these prophetic women. This is what I'm referring to as female spheres of power. even within patriarchal systems.
Yeah.
But, you know, for that example with the Stedingers, it's interesting. It's very it's a very thin layer of evidence, but at least the papal sources are rousing. They actually call a crusade to put down this rebellion of serfs, and they're characterizing it as female-led, you know, and with a spiritual dimension implied. So there are those pieces that, you know, are there to be turned up. And this was what was surprising to me when I began doing the research, because I didn't really believe that I would be able to find as much as I have been able to. And that goes triple for the indigenous societies in the global south.
Max Dashew, thank you.
Thanks.